Hello and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We are closing our series in the book of James today, and my sermon is entitled A Very Slow and Boring Sermon on Patience. A reading from the book of James, chapter 5, verses 7 to 11. James writes, "Be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious crop from the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also must be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Beloved, do not grumble against one another, so that you may not be judged. See, the judge is standing at the doors. As an example of suffering and patience, beloved, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we call blessed those who show endurance. You have heard of the endurance of Job and how you have seen the purpose of the Lord and how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." The word that shows up again and again in that passage is patience. And as we read this passage, we get the sense that James, who is the brother of Jesus Christ, is urging the people who say they follow Christ to be a patient people. So if you claim to follow the ways of Jesus, a question I'd like to ask you during this podcast is this: would your friends describe you as a patient person? If we could pull your friends into a room and ask them to talk about you, would one of the first descriptors they use to describe you be the word patient? Because James thinks that if you follow Jesus, you will become a more patient person. Now, before we go much further, it's important for us to define the word patience, because I have found that when I ask people to define the word patience, you get a wide variety of answers. So if we turn to the dictionary, in particular the New Oxford American Dictionary, the definition of patience there is this: the capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without getting angry or upset. I love this definition. Would your friends describe you as a person who has a great capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without getting angry or upset? Now, at this point, as the host of this podcast, it's not fair for me to ask you a question without turning that question back on me. Would people consider me, Craig Hadley, a patient person? After all, I'm a pastor, so I should be leading the way on this patient train, shouldn't I? But if you could get my friends in a room and ask them the question, is Craig a patient person? I have a feeling they respond with three words: ah, hex, no. In my lifetime, I have never heard my friends describe me as a patient person. When I gave this sermon on Saturday at Paradox, I even said I may be the least patient person in this room. I'm so impatient that one of my favorite scenes in a recent movie was in the movie Zootopia, when Officer Judy Hopps, who is organized and efficient and does her best to be a good police officer, finds a plate number and she needs it run by the DMV in a very quick manner. This is probably the most famous scene in the movie. So she goes to the DMV and she walks inside and she's shocked to find that the DMV is run by a group of sloths. She then runs up to the desk and says, "We are in a big hurry. I need you to run a plate number for me." She then dispenses the plate number to the sloth. And as she is dispensing the plate number to the sloth says, "Hi, how are you?" And Judy Hopps freaks out at every bit of inefficiency the sloth displays for being a sloth. The sloth takes so long to run the plate number, in fact, that by the time she exits the DMV, it is nightfall and she has lost precious time. And I remember watching that scene and saying, I feel this on a spiritual, fundamental level. I am not a very patient person, which is strange, because here I am as a pastor, and we're reading a passage on the importance of patience. And I'm not sure I'm a very patient person. Which raises the question, why are you listening to me? Right? Like, what could I possibly give you that could help you be a more patient person when I'm not really a patient person myself? There is some wisdom within the preaching tradition that goes something like this. If you preach about your weaknesses, then you'll never run out of material. And I am here on this podcast to tell you that I am not a patient person, and that's not okay. And I've got some work to do. And as I've reflected and studied and thought about what patience is over the past week in my own life, I have come to the realization that I have an enormous amount of work to do. So, if I am describing what patience is and what we need to become more patient people, and you're thinking to yourself, I know Craig, and this is not who Craig is, he is a hypocrite. I will tell you, no, I'm not a hypocrite, because I'm owning the fact that this is something I need to work on. I'm preaching from a position of weakness, and I'm preaching first and foremost for me, because this is stuff I need help with. So let's look at this virtue that is patience and see what role it should play in our lives in 2018, shall we? Now, when we look at the definition of patience, it is the capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without getting angry or upset. Now, what's interesting about this definition is that it ties together delay, trouble, and suffering together. And so the idea is that delay, while much less painful, is kind of the same root or the same problem as suffering. So when we drive around in our cars and we stop at a red light, that delay in some way, some form, is a very small iota of what it means to suffer. After all, you are not the king of the country and you can just have every green light that you want. At that red light, you have to stop and allow someone else go first as required by law. So when the dictionary points to delay, trouble, and suffering being the same thing, when we stop at a red light, that is in some very small, very insignificant way, suffering. Now that delay that we experience at a red light graduates into something else when we apply to colleges in high school. And when we get college acceptance letters, it's of course a good thing, and we celebrate and we say great things about the people that got us there. But we also get rejection letters from colleges, don't we? And when you get rejected from your dream college, I would classify that as trouble. And it is much more of an inconvenience or a problem than what we experience at a red light, but it is ultimately the same thing. And trouble then crescendos into suffering whenever we watch a loved one who is admitted to the hospital, and there are diagnoses, and there's uncertainty, and there's tears, and there's waiting, and there's hoping, and there's sometimes disappointment as we say goodbye. So from a stoplight to being rejected by college to saying goodbye to a loved one, the thing that ties all of these things together is it's when we do not get our way, when we would choose something different, and yet reality has this idea or this way of life in mind. So patience then is how we respond to those inconveniences and the pain that we would not choose. Patience is being able to somehow, some way hold on to joy, hope, peace, happiness, meaning, goodness, dignity, or some sense of sanity when things don't go our way. And so while we often think of patience as something that we teach our kids because that's something you need to learn as a kid, I realize that patience is necessary for maturity and is a journey that is worth taking. And we all have to become more patient people on this planet. So with that in mind, I'd like to say three different things about patience. that I have found to be helpful in my own life and things that I am striving toward and working toward, because I think that they are valuable things that need to be said about what patience is. So let's talk about the first idea behind patience. Let's return to James 5, verse 7, the first verse we read in the passage at the beginning of this podcast. We read, "Be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious crop from the earth, being patient with it until it receives the early and the late rains." Now, if we look at those first two words, be patient, they are taken from one Greek word in the original manuscript. And the Greek word is makrothumeo. And makrothumeo means to be of a long spirit. To be of a long spirit. And in order to talk about what it means to be of a long spirit, James points us to farmers. Now, farmers are fascinating people because when you talk about instant gratification, farmers don't know what you mean. You cannot plant a seed, water it, and then say, "Well, where is it?" No, instead, farmers plant seeds and then wait weeks and months until it is time to harvest and reap the benefits of their work that happened so long ago. Now, we often forget this, but there are farmers living with us today. And one of these farmers is a woman, a Buddhist nun named Jiang Kwan, who lives in South Korea. Now, Jiang Kwan is considered to be the world's greatest vegan chef on the planet. Now, Jiang Kwan farms a lot of the food that she puts into her dishes. And I've seen her being interviewed, and they ask her about how she farms, and she tries to make the farming process as natural as possible. She doesn't care how her garden looks as long as it grows right. And the person who was interviewing her eventually asks her about GMOs and adding all sorts of materials to make the plants grow faster and do all these things. And she responds by pausing and then looking at the man interviewing her and saying, "It is man's greed that wants the plants to grow faster." In other words, why is it that we are upset at the world for behaving the way that the world works? The only reason we would want the plants to grow faster than they do is because we want to make more money. To be of a long spirit is to look at the way the world works and not try to hurry it up, but to accept and embrace the pace of the world. There are these rhythms and these paces that have been built into the world that we have to acknowledge and embrace in order to become people of a long spirit. And when it comes to this world and the way that we move on it, a question arises: how do I take care of my human spirit? Because if I don't take care of my internal being and the health of myself, then how will I ever become a patient person? Another way to ask this is, what feeds my soul? And the best way to feed one's soul is to embrace the pace and the nature and the rhythm of this planet. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, we read about a rhythm that is interwoven into creation. This rhythm, this routine, is discussed in a poem that is found throughout chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. And the poem talks about how God first, on the first day of creation, separated the light from the darkness, and he called the light day and the darkness night, and that was the first day. Then on the second day, God separated the skies and the waters and created a space for creation to live in between, and that was the second day. Then on the third day, God created the land and the trees and the plants and the vegetation of the earth. And that was the third day. Then God created the sun, the moon, the stars, and created things to fill the light and the darkness. And that was the fourth day. And then God created birds to fill the sky and fish to fill the seas. And that was the fifth day. And then God created every animal that walks the earth, including men and women, according to Genesis 1, at the same time. And God created both of these beings in her image. And God saw that it was very good, and that was the sixth day. And when creation is complete, God is not done creating, Because then on the seventh day, God creates something else. God creates space for nothing. And he consecrates this day as the Sabbath day. And it is only when God gives space to create nothing that we find creation is complete. And so according to the Jewish tradition, there is this rhythm, there is this inherent beat that things of this creation follow, which requires 6 days of work or productivity or getting things done. And then there's this day where you do nothing and you wait and you enjoy and you pause. And the thing that's fascinating about our souls, the very fibers of our being, is that we need to be able to participate in something meaningful. The soul requires something that helps to contribute to the ongoing beauty of God's creation. And if you've ever been in a job that you would describe as soul-sucking, it's because you can't see how your work helps to make the world a better place. It's soul-sucking because our human being, our human nature, is the fact that we feel like we have to do something constructive. Now, we don't have to be the figurehead. We don't have to be the person at all the photo ops. But if you're an accountant and you're helping people get their finances in order, and they're just so grateful because you know they couldn't do this on their own, then that is helping to create order within the world, right? If you're an accountant at a business and your business is doing great things and you have a responsibility and a role that not many other people could fill, then you feel really good about what you do. But when you're an accountant at a big business where the most important thing is making money and looking at people and saying, how can we get the most money out of those people as possible? Then that's when you start to experience work that is soul-sucking. But if you are at a job that is helping and participating in the ongoing creation of this planet and the unfolding beauty of this world, then you will find that that work is not soul-sucking, but in fact gives your soul life, keeps you moving, gets you out of bed in the morning. And if you've been at a soul-sucking job for months now, then the best thing that you can do is leave. Have the courage to stand up and say, I need to find something that helps to participate in the ongoing creation of this planet that makes this world a better place. So when we ask the question, what feeds my soul? And we look at creation, we look at those first 6 days, and we say to ourselves, oh, I need to participate in something valuable. And something meaningful. That's what my soul needs. And I have found that every human being shares that desire. Now we, of course, express it in different ways. But our souls need something to make this world a better place. But it doesn't end there. And this is why the creation story is so important. If you spend every day of your life helping to make the world a better place, you will find that that life is soul-sucking as well. It's crazy, isn't it? You need a break from making the planet a better place. And when we look at the Sabbath and what it means within creation, God, who is infinitely better, who is infinitely more good than you or I could ever hope to be, God creates and creates and creates for 6 days and then pauses on the seventh day and says, this space, the ability to enjoy what we have worked toward, is just as important as what we are working toward. This paradox of the soul requires us to create for the majority of our lives and then to pause regularly on a weekly basis and enjoy the goodness of this existence. So when we ask ourselves the question, what feeds my soul? This is a very important question to ask. Because if you find yourself getting irritated at every little delay, the fact is your soul probably isn't fed. You need to find a job or a work or something you can do to participate in making this world a better place. And you also need to be able to articulate how you best restore and enjoy the goodness of this creation. Anytime someone asks you the question, what feeds your soul? There should always be a two-part answer. You should be able to talk about how you are participating in creation and how you are resting and savoring in creation. Because the fact is, patience requires the soul to participate and rest. And the only way I know how to move beyond getting upset and frustrated and angry with every little delay and inconvenience and even the big suffering is to make sure that my soul is well fed. And the fact is, this story and this farmer teaches us to be of a long spirit. We need to participate and rest. And if you remove either of those from your practice, your daily way of life here on this planet, then you will find that your existence is soul-sucking and you are an impatient person. So the first thought that we're talking about with patience is that patience requires the soul to participate and to rest. Which brings us to the second thought. In her book, I'm Still Here, author Austin Channing Brown writes about her experience growing up and living as a Christian Black woman in America today. She writes, "Christians talk a lot about love. It's one of our favorite words, especially when the topic is race. But I have found this love to be largely inconsequential. More often than not, my experience has been that whiteness sees love as a prize it is owed." Now, I'm going to pause right there because I am, in fact, a white male living in America today. And when I read her talking about whiteness, I immediately get defensive. Why? Well, it's probably because I have a fragile ego. And when I read about her talking about whiteness, I have to remember and I have to remind myself, and I would encourage anybody who's white that's listening to this podcast to remember this as well, is that you and I have rarely, if ever, lived in a country where we are the racial minority. And when we read this book, I'm Still Here by Austin Channing Brown, we read this book because we don't know what it's like to grow up in America as part of a racial minority. And so she is talking here about what it's like to be in the racial minority in America. So she says, "More often than not, my experience has been that whiteness, or the racial majority of America," which, let's face it, there's a lot of power in being part of the racial majority in America because we're a democratic system. The more numbers you have, the more power you have. So what she's talking about is what it's like to see the racial majority, which professes to be Christian, and their response. So let's keep reading. "More often than not, my experience has been that whiteness sees love as a prize it is owed rather than a moral obligation it must demonstrate." In other words, we feel that love is owed to us rather than something that we owe to others. She continues, "Love for whiteness dissolves into a demand for grace, for niceness, for endless patience to keep everyone feeling comfortable while hearts are being changed. In this way, so-called love dodges any responsibility for action and waits for the great catalytic moment that finally spurs accountability. This aloof kind of love is useless to me. I need a love that is troubled by injustice. I need a love that is provoked to anger when Black folks, including our children, lie dead in the streets. A love that can no longer be concerned with tone because it is concerned with life. A love that has no tolerance for hate, no excuses for racist decisions, no contentment in the status quo. I need a love that is fierce in its resilience and sacrifice. I need a love that chooses justice." Austin Channing Brown has heard a racial majority which is in power tell her to be patient over and over again. And her response to those pleas for patience is this: that is useless to me and to this country, and this so-called patience isn't love. Now, here's what's fascinating about James. It is possible that a government official could stand up in front of our nation and read James chapter 5 talking about the importance of patience and implore everyone that is experiencing racial tension within America to practice patience. But that would be a great misuse and misunderstanding of the passage. And in order to understand why that is, we need to talk about James. Now, if you've been with us in this series, you know that James is a poor and oppressed Jew. James is living under a political system that is corrupt, that doesn't have his best interest at heart, but is only interested in growing Rome. Not only that, but his own government, local government system has sold out to the Roman Empire. It is run by Jews, but they are all allegiant to Rome before they are allegiant to the Jewish people. And there is also a religious system which exercises power and taxes people and exploits their religious guilt for profit. So James is a poor and oppressed Jew living in Jerusalem. Yes, he is the head of the Jerusalem church, but that church is nothing like the church you and I know today. It is a very poor church as well. So James is a poor and oppressed Jew who fights on behalf of the poor and oppressed Jews. And when he writes his letter that we are reading today, it is important for us to understand that he is writing to poor and oppressed Jews as well. How different does his letter become if it's not written by a poor and oppressed Jew, but it is written by the emperor of Rome, a man named Nero, at the time of James' writing? Imagine that Nero is sending out a decree and he uses the same words that are found in James chapter 5, and he is imploring the poor and oppressed Jews who are discontent to be patient. While the words are the same, the entire meaning of this passage changes significantly. Because Nero now is going to the people who are discontent and saying to them, just wait, we'll fix it later. I know you're upset, but don't worry, we'll fix it later. And what he's almost saying is he's saying like, look, the system's really good for me. Wait until I die to change it. Imagine that during the same era, there are Roman officers who are the local law enforcement, and they unjustly start killing Jews just because they feel like it. It's a bit of fun, and they abuse their power as law enforcement officials, and they commit all kinds of unjust murder. The Jews were upset about this, so then they'd raise a complaint to local law enforcement, and they issue a statement that quotes James chapter 5, and they basically tell the poor and oppressed Jews not that they're going to change something or do something to confront this injustice, but instead they tell them to be patient. We're looking into it. We'll get around to it eventually. Well, the words are the same, but the whole meaning has shifted, hasn't it? Last week, we talked about the corruption of the religious system and how they profited handsomely off people's religious guilt. Let's assume for a moment that Annas, who was one of the most corrupt high priests in Jewish history, heard people complaining about how he was exploiting their guilt for profit. And in response, he writes James 5 to the poor and oppressed Jews and asks them to be patient. Yeah, it's entirely different, isn't it? And this is why reading the Bible with the context in mind is so incredibly important. Because James is part of the outcasts. James is part of the grassroots movement. And if he was in power, if he was one of the people officiating or one of the officials profiting off of this corruption, then his words change entirely. And I bring this all up to bring us to our second thought on patience. Patience in the hands of power becomes a weapon. Patience in the hands of power becomes a weapon. And so whenever people stand up and say, you know, it's important that we're patient, it depends on what that person is and how powerful they are. Because if a person in power who is profiting off the system says it's important that we're patient, it's almost like they're saying, just wait till I get out of power and change it because I'm doing pretty well in this current system. One of the worst injustices I've ever seen the American government commit is happening right now. When undocumented immigrants have attempted to cross our border, and from May 5 to June 9, our government felt it was right to separate children and take them away from their parents and put these children into cages made of chain link fence in abandoned Walmarts and separate these kids all across our country. 2,300 kids, some of whom have been living without their parents for over a month. This is awful. And I'm not alone in thinking this is awful. A lot of the American people have reacted by saying this is awful. And a lot of religious systems have responded by saying this is awful. Now, every now and then, as the horrendous evil of this practice has come to light, the American government has attempted to remind people of their religious duty to fulfill the law and then to even be patient. And if you've heard these calls from the government to be patient and it's rubbed you the wrong way, the reason why is because patience in the hands of power is a weapon. And if you are ever sitting there and someone tells you to be patient and it sounds annoying or frustrating, or you're like, no, that's not the right thing right now, ask yourself this question: where does the power lie? Because if a powerful person is telling you to be patient, the chances are they are using patience as a weapon. Just as important is if you ever tell someone else to be patient and they react negatively and you wonder why it was so poorly received that this person should receive the advice to be patient. Perhaps the reason is you are in a position of power. And the worst thing that this person who is not in power is feeling is to wait it out. Yes, justice requires us to be impatient, because we must never forget that patience in the hands of power is a weapon. And that is the second idea behind patience that I'd like to share with you today. Which brings us to the third idea. And to discuss the third idea about patience, I'm going to play an audio recording of my son taken just 2 months ago. My son was weeping because we did not allow him to play with Play-Doh. That's right. That recording is when we said, no, Bodhi, you can't play with Play-Doh. Why? Because very likely he would eat it and then suffocate and then die. And so we tell him, no, Bodhi, you can't play with Play-Doh. And he just decompensates, full on melts down. Now, at this point, you may ask, why did he melt down? And I will tell you, because he's a baby. And when he was 16 months old is when we took this recording. And that's expected behavior from a 16-month-old, because we all know that babies cry over the smallest things. 2 years ago, my daughter, who is now 4, wanted to hear some silly songs by Larry, which is from the popular series VeggieTales, which I'm sure you're a fan of. You're probably not as big a fan as my daughter, because when I told her that she had to wait until we went upstairs to listen to Sippy Cup, which is a silly song with Larry, she fell apart like a cheap Volkswagen. And this is what it sounded like.
What's wrong? You want silly songs? Can you just say, what silly song do you want? Sippy Cup?
Yeah.
Can you say Sippy Cup, please?
Sippy Cup, please.
Can you imagine not being able to hear a song for 5 seconds and just falling apart like that? like just ugly crying, the tears are falling down, the snot's coming out, over a song not being able to be played? While this seems so foreign and distant to us, we all went through a stage in our life where we cried just like Maya and Bodhi cried during these recordings. And something's changed. We've grown up. We're a little bit older now. And now we know that if we can't play with Plato, or if we can't hear a song right away, that it's not the end of the world. And that perspective comes with maturity. And so patience should push us further into that. To be of a long spirit should push us further into that perspective. And the third idea behind patience is that patience always asks a question whenever we experience delay or trouble or suffering or when we don't get our way. Patience asks the question, is this a setback or a tragedy? Is this a setback or a tragedy? Now, it's important for us to understand the difference between a setback and a tragedy because these two things require different responses from our humanity. A setback is an inconvenience without any long-term impact. For instance, when you want to play with Play-Doh and you can't right now. That is an inconvenience without any long-term impact. My son will not be standing up at his graduation and saying, you know what, I've faced trials. There was one time I wanted to play with Play-Doh and I couldn't play with Play-Doh, but I overcame that. No, he's not. This isn't a big deal, right? A setback is an inconvenience without any long-term impact. To give you another example, I once broke my hand skiing when I was in architecture school. And this was devastating because I was in the middle of a very intense program. And I understood that I had to make up a lot of work. And it was very sad when I broke my hand. But all it required was while my hand was broken, I had to wait. And then as soon as it was healed enough that I could do the work, I could catch up and get it going again. And now when I tell my life story, I rarely include that broken hand, even though it was a very big deal in the moment. So a setback is an inconvenience without any long-term impact. A tragedy is an indefinite or permanent loss of someone or something. Someone or something that you know you can't get back. That you understand will be an absence for an undefined amount of time or for the foreseeable future. And setbacks and tragedies require very different responses. Because in our human experience, a setback needs to be put into perspective. You can say to yourself, is this going to be an issue 1 week from now, 1 month from now, a year from now? And there's times that setbacks make us upset, and it's okay for you to say to yourself and for me to say to myself, I'm going to be mad about this for 2 days and then I'm going to move on. I'm not going to let this own me because this isn't a long-term impact. So setbacks need to be put into perspective. And that perspective gets easier to maintain and understand the older you get if you allow setbacks to teach you things. The older you get, the more you say to yourself, I've been through something like this before. It's not going to define who I am. But a tragedy requires a different response. Tragedies need to be grieved. And so often, when we miscategorize a tragedy as a setback, we get frustrated with ourselves because we can't move on. We can't put it into perspective. And we try to tell ourselves it's no big deal and it keeps coming back up. It is because what you have done is you've miscategorized a tragedy as a setback and it tells you you need to grieve this. You need to lament the fact that you have lost something. Tragedies need to be grieved. And you and I need to spend the appropriate amount of time weeping and crying and lamenting and remembering the losses that we have experienced. And sometimes this takes days. Sometimes this grieving takes months. Sometimes this grieving is something we carry for years. And sometimes this grieving is something that endures our whole life. When you talk about tragedies of losing a loved one, you never really get over it, do you? Instead, when patience asks the question, is this a setback or tragedy? If it's a tragedy, we can respond by saying, well, it's okay if I carry this with me because I will spend my life grieving and remembering in healthy ways the loss of this loved one. So my brothers and sisters, if you have lost a loved one, it's okay to grieve and to take your time grieving this loss. My hope and my prayer is that your testimony about Christianity is that Christianity helped you to grieve in healthier ways. That is the mark of a great religion. And we, as Christians, need to become experts in the practice of grieving. So when we talk about patience, we talk about three ideas. Patience requires the soul to participate and to rest. We also must remember that patience in the hands of power becomes a weapon. And lastly, may we have the courage to recognize that patience asks the question, is this a setback or is this a tragedy? And may you and may I become a more patient people as we follow the footsteps of Jesus Christ. My brothers and sisters, may we see and embrace Jesus Christ in all.